With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight we're going to look a little bit about the Sykes-Picot Agreement. If that's unfamiliar to you, as it might be to some listeners, this is the secret Anglo-French and also Russian, but the Russians are sort of forced out later on, compact to divide the Ottoman Empire. That is devised in 1915 as the product of secret discussions between the British and the French, and it is created, and it contradicts all agreements that the British give to the Arabs about the future of the Arab parts of the Ottoman Empire. The British have a habit during the First World War in the Middle East of making multiple promises with little intention of keeping any of them. So we're going to look tonight at A Line in the Sand by James Barr, which is an excellent history of the kind of cutthroat relationship between the British and the French in the first half of the 20th century. In the Middle East. It is followed up, if you, I've mentioned it before, by Lords of the Desert, which is the kind of equally brutal backstabbing relationship between the British and the Americans in the second half of the 20th century, motivated by the desire for Middle Eastern oil. Okay, so we're going to start by looking at the character of Sir Mark Sykes, who was the British diplomat and one of the few kind of Arabists in the the British government at the time in 1915. So here we're reading from the chapter Very Practical Politics in A Line in the Sand by James Barr. James Barr writes, late in the morning of December the 16th of December 1915, A promising young politician named Sir Mark Sykes hurried into Downing Street for a meeting. The Prime Minister had summoned the 36-year-old baronet to advise him and his war cabinet on how they might resolve a row about the future of the Ottoman Empire that looked as if it could tear Britain's fragile alliance with France apart. By extraordinary luck, Sykes put it afterwards, I was allowed to make a statement to the War Council. What he said was to shape the modern Middle East. Sykes' surprise at being called to Number 10 was genuine, for he had managed to carve himself a role as the government's chief advisor on Middle Eastern matters in the space of just 4 years. Elected as a Conservative Member of Parliament for the Yorkshire port of Hull in 1911, he staked his claim to being an expert on the Ottoman Empire in his maiden speech. It is in it he described a recent visit to North Africa, still then in Ottoman hands, and declared that he believed a strong and united Turkish Empire was an important was as important to English commerce and strategy now as it had been in Disraeli's time 30 years before. When the war broke out in 1914, the Ottomans had joined Germany to fight Britain and France, and Sykes had been forced to change his mind. So what Sykes was making reference to was the kind of the mid-19th century Eastern question, the idea of what was it in Britain's best strategic interests to do in the face of a weakening Ottoman Empire. Idea that a weakening Ottoman Empire would always benefit a strengthening and more belligerent Russian Empire was an article of faith for the Conservatives, who, whilst having no love for the Ottoman Empire at all, were happy to support it, Disraeli particularly, and this was it was Queen Victoria's view that this should happen as well. When William Gladstone, the Liberal Prime Minister, complained about the Balkan outrages, the Bulgarian outrages, where Bulgaria in 1876 rose up against the Turks and brutal massacres ensued. The Turkish Bashi Bazouk mercenaries burned their way across Bulgaria. This sort of enraged Russian pan-nationalist pan-Slavist passions, and was about to result in the Russians entering a war, which they do in 1877 and win it in 1878 against the Ottoman Empire. It was Disraeli's view that Britain should continue to support the Ottomans no matter what horrendous things they had done. Gladstone said, you know, this was rotten and immoral, and there were Christians being slaughtered in the Balkans. But British policy was unwavering. Always prop up the Ottoman Empire. Keep this sort of a zombie empire on its last legs going as long as you can do. So Sykes was a kind of an echo of that several decades later. And in the intervening time, particularly in the 1890s, the Kaiser had gone to great lengths to woo the sultans of the Ottoman Empire, and then the Young Turks, who from the CUP, who took power after 1908, This obviously involved like heavy modernisation of the Turkish army. I mean, there's been a couple of podcasts I've shared before about the shock that the British and the French have when they suddenly realise that the Turks aren't necessarily, in military terms, the sick man of Europe any longer, and they really can fight quite successfully. To the meeting with the War Council, Sykes brought a map and a three-page précis of what he was about to say. This document survives amongst the paperwork he left when 3 years later he died from influenza at the age of just 39. His distinctive, muscular but juvenile handwriting gives it the look of a schoolboy's last-minute revision notes, but it was by far the most significant thing he'd ever wrote. From the Tour de Horizon, it sketched it for the Tour de Horizon it sketched, helped him convince the cabinet that they must urgently reach agreement with France on how they should divide the Ottoman Empire between them, and that he was the man to mastermind the deal. Mark Sykes is an interesting character because the other Arabists who knew him didn't really rate his understanding or knowledge of the Middle East at all, and it looks more and more as if he had a kind of a bluffer's knowledge of the region, and was able to convince the war cabinet that he was the person who could shape the Middle East in Britain's interests. And you find that the history of British imperialism is chock full of these sort of blagger characters who sometimes have a degree of knowledge, but in other times their self-confidence outshines their abilities. This is the kind of the in some ways the dark genius of the British public school system, is to create those who have extraordinary confidence despite evidence to the contrary. He certainly is a capable fellow with plenty of ideas, but at the same time painstaking and careful, one minister reported afterwards of Sykes. But in truth, the genial MP was less expert on this subject than he led the cabinet to believe. Sykes's reputation as an authority on the Middle East rested on a series of books that he had written on the region, the latest being a 2-inch thick tome that he had published earlier that year. The Caliph's Last Heritage was part of a history of the rise of Islam as a political force, part dyspeptic diary of his pre-war travels to the Ottoman Empire. Spiced with Arabic phrases and comical dialogue, the book implied a deeper understanding than its author truly had. Sykes did not try to puncture this illusion. That day he left the Prime Minister and his colleagues under the impression that he was fluent in both Arabic and Turkish. In fact, he could speak neither. The book and its author's breezy self-assurance were both the fruit of an extraordinary upbringing. Sykes had been born into a dysfunctional landed Yorkshire family and made his first visit to the Middle East with his parents, the eccentric Sir Tatton and alcoholic Lady Jessica, at just the age of 11. Sir Tatton, obsessive about church architecture and the maintenance of his body at a constant temperature and milk pudding, was 64. Lady Jessica, who was barely half his age, was having an affair with their tour guide. Mark Sykes was their only child. The year was 1890. The Sykes family visited Egypt, which Britain had seized from the Ottomans 8 years earlier, and then went to Jerusalem and to Lebanon, still in Turkish hands. For Sykes, the sense of travelling back in time was mesmerising. It was also a distraction from his parents' unhappy marriage, which culminated in 1897 with a toe-curling court case that revealed their respective peccadilloes. During the period, Sykes escaped to the Middle East repeatedly, first as an undergraduate, then as a young honorary attaché at the British Embassy in the Ottoman capital, Constantinople. There's a fascinating biography of St. John Philby, who was the father of Kim Philby. Kim Philby is obviously the great MI6, Soviet model MI6, and the great British traitor. But St. John Philby was an Arabist like Sykes, and to some degree kind of contemporary at the time, though St. John Philby was far, far more accomplished and far more of the genuine Victorian gentleman explorer. Anyhow, there are really interesting parallels between the story, the backstory, the family history of St. John Philby and Mark Sykes, of these broken families producing sons who lack that kind of basic care, that nurture, and these broken families that exist on the kind of the peripheries of Britain's ruling classes, And the way in which Victorians and Edwardians romanticised and fantasised about the Islamic world, not just the Middle East, but Islamic India, and the way they kind of projected their own fantasies onto it, in some ways is a product of these peculiar aristocratic families where, as it says here, that Sykes escaped to the Middle East repeatedly to get away from all of this. Recounting how he had shot the lock off the door of an abandoned caravanessary so that he could stay there overnight, he gained a reputation as an intrepid, or rather free-spending, tourist. When he bumped into another traveller, Gertrude Bell, in Jerusalem, and admitted what he had what he'd paid for horses, she made a mental note to arrange her journey so as not to fall in with him, bless him. For if I know the East, prices will double all along his route. Like many travel writers, Sykes liked to pretend that he was going into unknown territory. He chose his routes, he claimed, by following his nose over the portions of the map which are the whitest or most rich in notes of interrogation and dotted lines. The sight of other Europeans spoiled the view. While Bell, like many other contemporaries, found Sykes most amusing, Sykes was much less pleased to come across Miss Bell. "Confound the silly chattering windbag of conceited, gushing, flat-chested man, woman, globe-trotting, rump-wagging, blethering ass," he ranted to his wife. The Ottoman Empire was by then going downhill, as Sykes had put in his first parliamentary speech. After the Sultan's government went bankrupt in 1876, the British government had abandoned a 50-year policy of supporting the Ottomans' integrity and independence as a bulwark against other powers' ambitions. In 1878, Britain seized Cyprus, and 4 years later Egypt and the Suez Canal in order to secure a route to India.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
As the canal turned out to be a major artery for Britain's growing eastern commerce, Egypt became the fulcrum of the British Empire. So, just to kind of take a pause there, What is the importance of talking about this one individual, Sir Mark Sykes, and his backstory? Well, I'm always wary of this idea that history hinges on individuals. It almost certainly doesn't. History is the product of large economic and social and structural changes. By and large, but at certain points we reach certain moments of kind of vulnerability. And when I say vulnerability to the role of it, of individuals, essentially Sykes is summoned to see Lloyd George after Lloyd George knows that something major has to be agreed with France over the future of the Middle East, over the future of oil that's been discovered there. And he simply says, who knows about this stuff? And the answer is, well, not many people. And actually, not really Mark Sykes, but he's there in the moment with a smattering of knowledge and a smattering of experience, and he can put forward a convincing case as to what should happen. And these are the moments where history takes particular directions. But it's the pressures of war and empire and economics and rivalries that give the likes of Sykes a momentary opportunity. So on to talk about Egypt. Well, British investors took what they took what was left of their money and ran, following the Ottoman default. The French moved in to replace them. The French already enjoyed significant prestige within the Ottoman Empire through their religious institutions, which ran dozens of schools that were better and more popular than the Ottoman equivalents. In an attempt to take advantage of the Turks' decrepitude, they now bought up most of the Ottoman government debt, gambling more than their own government's annual revenue on the Ottoman's survival. But the Young Turks, who seized power in a coup in 1909, failed to stop the rot. They lost Libya and the empire's remaining European possessions in the Balkans 3 years later. The Ottoman Empire's centre of gravity now shifted significantly eastwards. Besides Turkey itself, the Ottomans now controlled only Syria, Palestine, Iraq, and the coastal fringes of the Arabian Peninsula. Of course, you know, the centre of the Arabian Peninsula was largely impenetrable to the Turks until they built trains across it. And yet, despite the Ottomans' decay, the Sultan remained remained influential across the wider Sunni Muslim world as the Caliph, or the successor to the Prophet Muhammad, and the guarantee and the guardian of the three holiest cities in Islam: Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem. This was the Caliph's last heritage, but even there, the Ottomans faced discontent from increasingly self-confident Arabs who wanted a greater autonomy or even independence from the dynasty that had ruled them for 400 years. Sykes's travels throughout the empire coincided with this era, and not surprisingly, in his latest book, he portrayed the Ottoman as moribund. So the writings of most kind of Victorian colonialists and Victorian sort of Arabists or Orientalists had a sort of this kind of dual contradictory sort of relationship with the subjects they observed, obviously not meeting them in any kind of meaningfully equal way. They viewed them as, you know, fascinating and yet kind of something that appalled them as well. To reinforce his argument, he included sublime descriptions of the squalor that he encountered in famous cities of the Ottomans' eastern lands. In Aleppo, a city where ruinous modern buildings clung for support to ancient and more solid edifices, he found that dirt and disease reigned in its crowded and crumbling bazaars. Decay and poverty were the most notable characteristics. In Damascus, he was assailed by packs of filthy dogs, ragged soldiers, yelling muleteers, greedy antique sellers, and dismayed by the ill-appointed hotels, tough mutton and rank butter. He saved his deepest opprobrium from Mosul, a foul nest of corruption, vice, disorder and disease, in which the new houses are as ramshackle, as insanitary, as stinking as the old, and the old as ugly, uninteresting and repulsive as the new. The souks there were ankle-deep in decayed guts and offal, and kennels ran with congealed blood and stinking dye in sluggish and iridescent streams, nauseous to behold and abominable in odour. So this is the language of the kind of the colonial explorer, really, who is stepping outside of what they conventionally see as civilization and looking with kind of abject horror, but sort of a kind of a fascination at the same time at the Arab world, and writing for the benefit of a British audience. So I would imagine a very small British audience, but a British audience nonetheless. Sykes sounded appalled, and yet in truth he did not want this colourful, decaying society to disappear, depriving him of the glimpse into the medieval world it gave him on his holidays. As the influence of jockeying foreign powers began to manifest itself, he was delighted that the dividers, T-square and drawing board of the French engineer have been able to crush out the originality of the illiterate Syrian Arab. These are his words. He ignored the fact that the railways, which the Ottomans were building with German help, were making cheap travel a possibility for Arabs whose horizons had previously been limited by how far they could walk or ride. Instead, he claimed, the steam train had brought not a single virtue, and only a host of new vices that included alcohol, dirty pictures, phonographs, and drinking saloons. How a postal service, the telegraph, the railway, a thriving newspaper industry, and growing literacy were about to change the Arab world forever, he either could not see or did not want to see. So there we have Sykes and his recollections of the Arab world just on the eve of the First World War, as he is suddenly perhaps not quite aware that of the growing German influence in the Middle East, and the fact that modernity was about to convulse the Arab world in ways that couldn't previously have been imagined. There's a previous interesting point about the holy sites in the Ottoman Empire, and in the Islamic world, in fact. In his really amazing book on the Balfour Declaration, Jonathan Schneer writes about Sharif Hussein of Mecca, and who is the king, essentially the ruler of the Hejaz, which is on the eastern seaboard of Arabia. And Sharif Hussein of Mecca rebels, obviously, in 1916. You know, if you ever watched the movie Lawrence of Arabia, he rebels in 1916 against the Ottomans. But the argument that Jonathan Schneer puts forward is that he rebels against the Ottomans because of modernization in the Ottoman Empire, that the Sharif Hussein of Mecca had never really accepted the modernization of the empire that occupied him, and the diminished role of Islam in the new new more modern, not necessarily particularly secular, but more modernized empire. And the revolt was less about, you know, fighting for Arab freedoms, and more a kind of a reaction, you know, reactionary kind of counter revolt against the forces of modernization, which were, in the eyes of Sharif Hussein, kind of oppositional to the kind of the proper workings of traditional Islam. Sykes allowed his prepositions to run away with his judgment, wrote one critic. But beyond academic circles, the shortcomings of his book, in particular its underestimation of the Turks, were largely overlooked. That, of course, you know, these underestimations of the Turks and the belittling of them, when kind of extrapolated that into a kind of a wider intellectual culture in pre-war Britain, this has serious consequences, because this shapes how British people viewed the prospects of going to war against the Turks in 1914, and as previously mentioned, Britain's in for a few shocks. Another reviewer commented, the facts that he has collected will be of the highest value when the settlement of the Eastern Question comes to be undertaken. The Caliph's Last Heritage helped earn Sykes the nickname the Mad Mullah across Whitehall, A place on a committee considering the future of the Middle East, and now a summons to number 10 to address the Eastern question, the long-winning argument over who would take over when finally the Ottomans collapsed, and to which the British and the French were each certain that they were the only answer. Okay, so we're going to take a pause there. I really want to return to this book. It's a superb history, and perhaps we'll look at that in the next couple of weeks. I'm doing as well. I teach at an online school called Kings in Time. This is not an advert for them, and they don't pay me. Well, they pay me my wages as a teacher, but they're not paying me to mention them. But I have some great students there, and I'm doing a kind of an extra thing for them in the next few weeks. It's a little experiment, and if it works out, we'll do more of it. So in the next few days, I'm going to record essentially a study lesson. Now, feel free, everybody, wherever you are, if you are studying fascist Italy, to listen along and use it to make notes and use it in whatever way you want. But just letting you know, there'll be an extra recording. It might be an extra one every week or a fortnightly going out, and I'll sort of number it and label it, and so that you don't kind of confuse it with the general sessions that I do. But we'll be covering a couple of topics this year, mainly fascist Italy and Stalinist Russia. But we'll sort of be doing it in a more structured study guide kind of way. So if that's useful to you, give us your feedback. I'd love to know what you think, and maybe we'll do more of that kind of thing. Anyway, thanks very much. Thanks to everyone that sponsors us on Patreon. We've got some really, really great, generous backers there. Very, very grateful to you all. Do remember to swing by the Explaining History Facebook group. I'll be putting some new stuff up there soon. And if I can gouge the time out next week, going to be doing a bit of writing. And, of course, do subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is flourishing at the moment. We've got a whole 1,100 subscribers, which, doesn't sound like a lot, but it is. Anyway, thanks very much. I've gone on far too long. Have a great week, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.